I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on Inland Journal, two items about making improvements to Spokane County's criminal justice system. We'll hear about expanding a well-received program that pairs police officers and mental health professionals on patrol. And a task force studying Spokane's criminal justice system is coming to consensus on a variety of measures meant to ease the pressure on the overcrowded jail. But first, we talk with our Olympia correspondent about the results from Tuesday's election, specifically the statewide measures, which include the passage of another $30 car tab initiative and an affirmative action referendum. Our correspondent Austin Jenkins joins us. So, Austin, let's start with Initiative 976. Here in Spokane, we saw lots of TV commercials who were warning from Chamber of Commerce types, I might add, warning that 976 was bad news. Why do you think it passed, and passed with a strong margin?
Well, you know, this has been described as a bumper sticker issue. Everybody gets it. $30 car tabs and what's not to like. And it's been popular before. It's passed before. This is a Tim Iman special, if you will. He regularly proposes these initiatives. Doesn't always get them qualified, but when he does, they tend to be successful. So I don't think there's any real surprise to see it passing despite the opposition. And the opposition did include a fairly robust coalition that included business interests as well as labor interests and those who were warning that the sky would fall if this passes. But for voters, especially those in the central Puget Sound region who are fed up with very high car registration fees in the hundreds of dollars because of Sound Transit, this was perhaps the bit of relief they were looking for and the ability to let government know they're not happy.
And so we're worried here in Spokane, as we think about this, about the North-South Freeway, which has forever been on the drawing board and is now about halfway done, and they're starting on the second half. Do we know anything about how how much money will be taken out of transportation due to this I-976?
The number that's been used pretty widely is about $4 billion over 6 years, and that would be in lost transportation dollars to state projects as well as local transportation and transit. So a very significant amount of money. Sound Transit in Central Puget Sound again would be affected, but so would transit agencies around the state. And one of the biggest areas of concern is the effect on transit services for the disabled. When you're looking at those big projects like the North-South Freeway, it's going to be up to the legislature when it comes back in January to start to look at whether, you know, A, what's the consequence here? What is the actual hit? And then are there opportunities to backfill either with existing funds or to find a new funding source? And I think that, you know, it's very likely to see that conversation start revving up even before January.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. With a short session coming up, is this a new issue that has just all of a sudden landed right back in the legislature's lap?
Yes and no. It's not like they didn't have some warning of this. In fact, this was an initiative to the legislature that the legislature took a pass on and let go to voters. Already we're seeing Republicans saying, in essence, to majority Democrats, we told you so, that there were opportunities to head this off, perhaps, to address one of the key areas of concern and heartburn was the way that Sound Transit, and I hate to keep mentioning that for an East Side audience, but it is central to understanding I-76 and sort of the pressure around it. There was a lot of frustration in the way that the Sound Transit light rail system values cars in the belief that they were overvaluing vehicles in order to extract a higher registration fee from drivers. Republicans had proposed bills around this. Democrats didn't embrace those. There was a suggestion that they go back to Kelley Blue Book valuations, which is what's in the Initiative 976. That didn't pass. And so there's this sense on the part of Republicans that Democrats failed to act and now look at the hole that essentially has been dug in the sense of a potential funding crisis now for some of these transportation projects. And yeah, they're going to have to figure out something, but whether they can make everybody whole again, I think, is probably unlikely. It's also likely that there will be a legal challenge to this initiative. We've seen that in the past, and we've seen those legal challenges be successful previously.
So that is the relatively easy one to understand out of the two, Referendum 88, which was what do we think about affirmative action? And to me, and I think to a lot of voters, it had that feel of a double negative that you sort of don't know what was going on here. How much do you think that played into the fact that the referendum is now, I guess, about 3 or 4 points behind?
It's hard to know. It's certainly what the supporters of affirmative action are saying might explain why this is the repeal effort is succeeding, because you're right. And this was actually extra complicated because it started out with Initiative 1000, which was an initiative to the legislature. The legislature passed I-1000 at the end of the 2019 session, but then opponents of affirmative action went out to voters to collect signatures for a referendum on I-1000. So it was confusing, and was a vote for R-88, you know, to approve? Was that approving? You know, people are sitting there thinking, what does that mean? So I think there could be a confusion factor. I also think that this is a lower turnout off your election. Certainly we saw people who were pretty galvanized around car tabs show up. It may have been the people who were galvanized around this issue of affirmative action showed up. It may also be that a lot of people looked at this and just said no because it was too confusing. Hard to know. What I will tell you is that backers of affirmative action don't think the issue is dead. Even if they don't prevail here, they're hoping that the conversation can continue in the legislature and that it won't be another 20 years before the issue comes up again. Because remember, it was more than 20 years ago that voters passed Initiative 200 that effectively banned affirmative action, and it really hasn't been an issue until now, with the caveat that there were efforts to repeal I-200 in the legislature that didn't go anywhere.
So then there were a dozen advisory votes on tax hikes that the legislature had enacted in 2019, and as I went, at least early in the evening, I think all but one were the voters were saying, repeal, repeal. So what does this really mean?
This is, again, the fact that we get to vote in a non-binding way on tax increases is courtesy of Tim Iman, who is also the backer of the I-976 initiative. These advisory votes on taxes typically are a way for voters to express their pent-up frustration over taxes and to express their dislike for taxes. And so it's very often the case that the advisory votes that the majority of voters say we should reject or overturn these taxes. Of course, that's not going to happen because these are just advisory votes. But it is an opportunity for people to weigh in. And it's hard to know. You know, maybe the people who are really motivated to vote for these, knowing that they're not binding, are people who just want to make it clear how frustrated they are and how much they don't like it. And others who are less upset about the taxes maybe skip them. On the other hand, we also in this state have kind of a long tradition of being not too favorable towards taxes. And so it may be a way of getting a pulse of the people and showing that there is some disconnect between what Olympia does and what the voters are feeling at home sitting around the kitchen table voting these days.
So, Austin, there were 12 of these advisory votes from tax increases that had been passed by the legislature, and I don't expect you to run down the whole list, but I noticed that there weren't very many that passed. Do you have a sort of a feeling as to what voters said yes to and what they said no to?
It is interesting to note that three of these tax advisory votes, the majority of voters are saying maintain them, and those three involve a new tax on vaping products, eliminating the sales tax exemption that shoppers from Oregon have enjoyed when they come across the border, and then also an increase in the business and occupation tax, this is the ballot language, on certain international investment management services. So perhaps voters were actually reading each of these advisory votes and learning about each of these taxes and deciding which ones they thought were appropriate and which ones they thought were inappropriate, and were happy to tax maybe a sin product, if you will, in quotes, tax out-of-state shoppers and tax big corporate investment firms. But all the rest of those taxes, they were saying, get rid of them. But of course, we won't get rid of them because it's just an advisory vote.
Austin Jenkins is the Olympia correspondent for the Northwest News Network and the host of Inside Olympia on TVW. In the debate about homelessness in the just-completed Spokane City election, one program implemented recently in Spokane received near-universal praise. That was the partnership between Frontier Behavioral Health and local law enforcement agencies. Using grant money from the state, Frontier and the agencies have developed 5 2-person law enforcement counselor teams who go out together on police patrols or medical runs. The mental health professional has been trained to intervene in cases where there might be a mental health issue. The goal is to divert people who might normally be sent to jail to a more appropriate option, such as a treatment facility. And now Frontier has won a second grant to expand that program. This comes from the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, and it's a little different than the first program. Jan Tokumoto is the Chief Operating Officer for Frontier Behavioral Health.
Currently, we have 4 co-deployed teams with the Spokane Police Department and 1 co-deployed team with the Spokane Sheriff's Office. We were awarded a contract by WASPIC, the Washington Association of Sheriff and Police Chiefs, in July 1 of this year. And that contract will allow us to add 2 more co-deployed teams to the Spokane Police Department and 2 more to the Spokane Sheriff's Office. We will lose a current co-deployed team with the Sheriff's Office, but now we have these 2 to replace the one that we're losing.
So what are the results that tell you that this is a good thing?
We keep data on all of the encounters that we have, and what we see is with every month that goes by, we see an increase in encounters, we see an increase in our diversion rate from jail and from the emergency departments. And what we also see is a strong partnership that's being forged with entities like community court, with our local jail, because we are involved with each of those entities because they have the population that we're interested in serving.
So what are your challenges in training the people who go out and work with the police officers, with the fire officers?
You know, we have such a good relationship with law enforcement that we share in that training. So issues of safety, issues of understanding that culture within law enforcement, they provide that to our mental health professionals. And in return, we provide training to their officers about mental health issues. So these officers have gone through the crisis intervention team training, which is a 40-hour training that we provide along with law enforcement. And for our co-deploy teams, they get trained in enhanced CIT.
So have you had to hire new people to be part of this new group, or do you pull from your existing staff?
You know, we have been fortunate in that the original co-deployed teams that we've had, that they have stuck with us. So we've not had staff turnover for our original team. These 4 new positions that we have acquired through the grant with WASPIC are all new staff. And law enforcement and Frontier, we are in the process of hiring those staff. One of the things that we got out of this contract with WASPIC is we were able to hire a sergeant that will be over all of our co-deployed teams. So that is huge because that gives us 1 person that now we can all coordinate services with.
So how does this increase the amount of service, the amount of time that your co-deploy teams can be out on the streets?
This grant allowed us to create a dedicated team where the only calls these teams will take are behavioral health calls versus our current co-deployed teams. Those teams take all calls for service. So we're really excited about this dedicated team through this WASPIC grant because not only will they only be receiving calls that are related to behavioral health, but they will now be able to do follow-up calls. So if they see someone today, they can see them tomorrow, next week, or next month.
So I'm going to go take a step back. We're talking about True Blood and the Washington Association of Police Chiefs and Sheriffs. Why those two are different? Tell me how.
They are different because under the True Blood grant, our original grant, those teams are a mixture of BA level staff and master's level clinicians, and they take all calls for service, but they cannot do any follow-up with the people that they have contact with. So a lot of times what they're doing is referring any follow-up services to Frontier's Mobile Community Assertive Treatment Team, our MCAT team. Versus with WASPIC, now we have a dedicated team and they will only take mental health calls and they will provide their own follow-up services. I think what's even more exciting about this whole grant is that there are other contracts that are being made available through the healthcare authority. And Frontier has applied for several of these contracts, and we have been successful in receiving a contract where we will have a forensic care team, where the state will provide us with a list of individuals who have been True Blood class members that they would like us to locate and assist, so we can connect them with resources and services so we can decrease their recidivism rate and their use of emergency departments. So we are in the process now of creating this forensic care team. The other contract that we were just awarded is one that's called HARPS, and this is a housing contract. So with this contract, we will have a housing specialist and a couple peers, and their sole purpose is to help us house these individuals, because we know without housing, that is such a basic need, and it is such a destabilizing factor when you don't have that in place. So along with the True Blood grant and the WASPIC grant, we now have other resources that we can have this team access specific to this population. So we feel that our opportunity to stabilize individuals within our community and to decrease that recidivism rate and the use of EDs, we should be able to impact that.
So you're piecing it all together in terms of the financial way of doing this. Grants often have an ending date. What happens when those grants run out and then you want to try to keep this service going?
One of the things that we've started from the initial grant is looking at sustainability. How do we, if these grants were to go away, how do we keep these programs going, because we are getting such good results that to lose that in our community, I think would really, it'd be a huge loss. And so we have been looking at the issue of sustainability from day one. We have engaged with someone at WSU to help us with some research so that we can start looking at what we're doing, seeing the efficacy of it and the outcomes, and promoting what we're doing.
So you're going from four people in those co-deploy units to eight, is that correct?
Correct.
Could you handle more if you had the money?
You know, that's a really good question, because statewide there is a workforce shortage. And so we are all scrambling to find that person, because it is a unique person that would fill this type of position. You don't get trained in school for this. There are no courses that you can really take with an emphasis on crisis intervention and outreach and stabilization. So the workforce issues are challenging, but one of the work groups under this True Blood, the 2019 True Blood settlement, is to look at workforce development. So that's something that the state, the healthcare authority, is looking into to see how do we create, you know, a workforce that's available to all of us.
Jan Tokumoto is the Chief Operating Officer for Frontier Behavioral Health, which is working with Spokane law enforcement agencies to bring more mental health expertise to first responder calls. Spokane's Justice Task Force will make recommendations to the county commissioners within a few months about replacing or modifying the county jail. Its proposal will go beyond just the size and scope of a physical facility. The recommendations will also include reforms to the county's criminal justice system that are meant to reduce the number of people who would be routed to the jail. One particular emphasis is on getting people who have some sort of business with the court, whether it be a traffic ticket or a crime, to show up when they're supposed to. People who skip out are often tracked down and jailed and kept in custody until they're due in court again. The task force met last week to review and refine its recommendations. Maggie Yates is the administrator for the Spokane Law and Justice Council. She oversees the Justice Task Force. She has been overseeing the review of the county criminal justice system.
There were actually three shared recommendations across all three committees. One was advocating for a redesign of the paperwork that individuals get, telling them to come back to court, making it much clearer what the consequences are for failing to make a court appearance, and also making that court date front and center on the paperwork so folks have, it's easy to identify. We also all agreed on expanding court date reminders. Currently, we do have court date reminders, but we're missing a number of individuals who are booked and released from our jail or who post bond. So we're working with Detention Services and with UpTrust, who provides the court date reminders with our county public defender, to start providing court date reminders for individuals right at jail booking and getting them enrolled in the system sooner. And then the third area of shared consensus across the committees is supporting and investing in resources across the community. What came up a lot in our committees and in the Justice Task Force meeting just this week was the emphasis on housing and behavioral health treatment. And there was a lot of interest in identifying and investing in housing specific to individuals who are returning home from jail or prison.
When I think about this whole big idea of building a new jail, this is pretty small potatoes. You're talking about recommendations about redoing little forms. Why is that stuff important?
There's not necessarily a decision to build a new jail at this point. This whole process is to first identify whether we need a new jail. And in that conversation, we need to figure out where are opportunities for us to be doing better. And so all of these intervention points that the various committees have identified will influence that decision whether or not we need a new jail, and will influence, if that answer is yes, what the subsequent plans will look like, both in terms of how the facility is designed and built and what that number would be. But because we're not at that point yet, we're sort of taking stock of where we are and taking stock of where we can be doing better. And that's starting with a review of what we currently are doing and what we could be doing in addition to those programs. Rethinking incarceration was the committee focusing on jail population and jail management, as well as the court system as well. And that committee agreed that increasing sort of the services that we offer to folks who are released in pretrial would be beneficial. They specifically looked at a program in New York City, which is called Supervised Release, where individuals are connected to social workers in lieu of having a bond set. And those social workers then help them identify what their needs are and get access to resources. The social workers also work closely with peer navigators, and peer navigators are individuals who have similar lived experience. So they have a different ability to connect with clients and really support them through what can be some of the most difficult moments in someone's life. So there's actually a cohort of individuals who are traveling to New York next week to meet with the staff of the supervised release program there and observe some of their work to learn even more and in even more detail to see how that could be replicated locally. Another recommendation that came from this committee and was discussed at the task force meeting was looking at the opportunity to expand our bail review pilot. That's a program that is funded by the MacArthur Foundation Safety and Justice Challenge, and it just started a couple of months ago. We're starting out on a very small scale, and that was really inspired by the New York supervised release model, where individuals held on a low bond who also have behavioral health issues or symptoms can be connected to resources in the community through the support of a clinical social worker and then released to these voluntary services rather than being held in jail where the services are limited. And another recommendation was providing an opportunity for individuals to resolve their cases at Warrant Fest. Warrant Fest is an event that has been held in the community for the last several years, and recently all three courts have joined together to recall warrants and set people out another court date so they don't have this fear of being arrested hanging over their head due to an outstanding warrant. The Rethinking Incarceration Committee likes that program and thought, you know, it would be even more effective if we were actually resolving cases when people came in to recall their warrants rather than just setting them up for a future court date, where, of course, there's always the risk of someone failing to appear for court because maybe they couldn't get work off, they couldn't arrange for child's care, or they forgot. So in Minneapolis, we found that the jurisdiction there was also holding similar events to Warrant Fest, but providing opportunities for community service to resolve those cases. That was discussed at the task force meeting. We talked about some of the limitations to offering community service, some of the best practices that scholars recommend in terms of what to do when you're offering community service, and then also deciding whether we would want to resolve the case as with a sentence of community service or dismiss the case when community service was completed. That wasn't necessarily decided, but that was some of the discussion revolving around that recommendation. Another recommendation that was proposed by both the Rethinking Incarceration Committee as well as the Community Collaboration Committee is coordinated releases, or something we call oftentimes a warm handoff, getting someone ready to come back home with a case plan or some sort of support already in place. We looked at many different models of how this could be implemented, and that included creating a very well-defined and well-structured collaboration point between detention services or jail staff and community providers. We also looked at models where community providers could come in and see their clients or meet new clients and start planning with them there. I was actually just in the jail this week and met with some men and women, and some of them spoke very eloquently about their fear when they're going to be released, because they want to be home, but they also don't know what's waiting for them. They don't know where they're going to go to live, and they don't know where they can access resources. So a program like this or a model like this can really help alleviate some of that fear and get folks ready to come back home and be really successful when they do. The last recommendation that came out of that committee was incentivized probation. This was a model that Louisiana implemented recently, and basically instead of bringing someone back to court when they're breaking the rules that are imposed by probation, in Louisiana, they take time off of your probation sentence as long as you're meeting all of the conditions. So for every meeting you make with your probation officer, you can get some time knocked off. And then if maybe you fail to meet with your probation officer for whatever reason, instead of coming back to court for that, you would just have some additional time added back on that had already been taken off. So that's another opportunity to make sure that folks who are doing well don't need to have additional burdens imposed on them through probation, and then folks who could use additional support remain in the program with additional help.
So your subcommittees have issued a whole bunch of recommendations. Who acts on them?
The full task force voted toward the end of the meeting, and many of these recommendations were overwhelmingly supported. Some had full consensus of the task force based on the votes that we received, and some still had some outstanding questions. So the committees will continue to meet and address those questions and potentially identify additional initiatives to present to the task force. Our next task force, which we are hoping to schedule later this winter, will be looking at the forecasting produced by the JFA Institute. And so this will look at different models of what our jail population could look like in the future. It will include a baseline. If we don't change any policy, this is what our jail population would look like. And if we decide to invest in different policy initiatives, then we'll get numbers about how that could potentially impact our jail. And then at that point, the task force will need to digest all of that and determine where and how we want to invest as a community. Once we have that decision, we'll make a recommendation as a task force that will ultimately go to the Board of County Commissioners.
Maggie Yates is the administrator for the Spokane Law and Justice Council. You can read more about the three subcommittees and their recommendations at the Spokane Justice Task Force website. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's public affairs radio program and podcast. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play, or hear it at the Spokane Public Radio website. We appreciate your support. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.